Hello and welcome back to the UK's number one and also the UK's longest running retro gaming podcast show. This is Retro Asylum. My name is Dean Swain, and we've got the Christmas decorations out, and also in that box I found Matt.
Hello.
Hello. Where'd you spring from?
Well, a Christmas decorations box, mate. Yeah. I normally come out once a year, don't I? But, you know, in my normal glory hunting way, when you tell the listeners what's happening on this show, they'll know why I'm back, basically. But no, it's nice to be back, actually. It's nice to be back. It's nice to be back before Christmas, so I can get a bit of preamble in before
the
whatever we're doing at Christmas this year. We're not told anyone yet, have we? So,
yeah, wheels are in motion for that already and have been for a little while.
Yeah, it's a sequel to last year.
And it's all the same people involved, so it'll be a good thing.
Yeah. But yeah, it's nice to be back on once in a blue moon, you know.
Yeah, that's it, mate.
Yeah,
very nice. Right, Matt. A few weeks back, quite a few weeks back now, because I was away on holiday when it was announced. The Spectrum. By Retro Games. What do you think of this?
Well, I've got a lot of respect for Retro Games. They've delivered on all their promises so far. I think that's fair to say. You know, did the C64 Mini to start with, then they come with the big one, then they did the VIC-20 and the Amiga, and then now this. But this is fully functional, 48K homage, replica, whatever you want to call it, with rubber keys, the whole shebang. It looks really, really good. Am I interested in it? I think so. I think I would be. I'm no longer a Spectrum Next owner, much to my dismay now when I think what a beautiful bit of kit it is. But yeah, I like it. I think, again, they've done a really good job with it. And as I've heard from you, maybe a bit later on in this show already, because I've been in the future, as we're going to step back as well.
Yes.
Well, you can load from... Yeah, time travel here. You can load from tape, right?
Well, not quite. No, you can't hook it up to a cassette. But what you can do is the images that are on there, I'm assuming if it's the right sort of image, it will load up as if it is a tape. So you'll get the dot tap files. You'll get the loading screen and it will take the same amount of time it would take to load a normal cassette. So it gives that impression that you're loading up.
Okay. So I could hook up my iPhone or something. Yeah.
It will still be able to load up games instantly.
Mm.
Or more or less instantly. But you've got the option.
Yeah. And if they announced all the games yet? Because I know it's been around for a few weeks now, hasn't it? And they were
Okay. Yeah, they have. I can't remember. It's a decent lineup of games. I know there's a Spanish version that's got quite a few Dynamic games included, because Dynamic Software was a Spanish company and the Spectrum was big in Spain. So they get an exclusive version with a few more Dynamic releases than what the UK and the rest of the world will get.
Okay. Oh, yeah. So I've got the list here now, and there is... It's good, actually.
Yeah.
And I like that they've done 48. That's a nice little nod to it. But just little things like Stonkers. Wheelie. Oh, great games there. Trash Man as well. Yeah, there's some great games there, actually. I mean that's obviously playing to the retail market, isn't it? The folk like us are gonna chuck on our own
that's
games.
It. You get a USB stick a load of games on, plug it in, and away you go.
Yeah, but knowing that this is gonna be in Argos and Amazon and all those, you know, actually in and probably in stores, you're probably gonna be able to walk into the likes of Curry's. Well, you can still walk into Argos this day.
Is Curry still a thing?
Yeah, Curry's is still a thing. Yeah, definitely. We've got one down. We got one down the road. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, it was Argos PC World, wasn't it? Argos is still. Yeah. Well, it's a thing in Sainsbury's now.
Sainsbury's now. Yeah.
Yeah. There's the odd one or two that's still a standalone store, but it's owned.
Yeah, we've lost all of ours. We've lost all of ours. Oh, you've got to go to Sainsbury's now, and they're always in a town, so it's really hard to get to. So anyway, But I think it's a great bit of kit, mate. I really do. Whether I'll end up with one, I can't guarantee that. But it's a nice Christmas gift, and I know they've worked hard to get it out before this Christmas, which is good for them commercially, obviously. But it's a nice thing for us, you know, us retro folk, seeing a retro bit of kit on the shelves again, you know.
Yeah. No, I'm looking forward to it. Like I say, I might not buy one, probably not, because I've got other means of playing. Spectrum Games got the Next, I've got the Mister, I've got a Plus 2 up there, which was my original one from back in the day. But a lot of people have been knocking it, saying, oh, it's cheap rubbish and what have you. But I don't agree. Listen, I think for the price, it looks decent. It will allow people who haven't played a Spectrum in years to come back to it and plug it into a modern TV. And it'll bring people who never did play a Spectrum, they can experience that colour clash-tastic feel.
Listen, there's always going to be the naysayers, the people who are going to throw mud at it, right? There's a purist who probably do it. And I don't mean that disrespectful to any of the listeners who are along those lines of going, oh, no, it's a pile of rubbish. Mm. But it appeals to the mass market. And that's obviously, they're a business. That's what they're trying to do. But I still think it's got enough pull and draw for someone like myself, who is mainly an emulator these days, bar the odd little system, that ease of plugging it into the TV, like you mentioned to me pre-show. Yeah. I think that's the boon for someone like me, where I can just hook it up downstairs really nice and easily. But you can add your own games. You can code on it if you want to. You know, it is. Yep. I think that's a good thing. The fact it's fully functional and it's got BASIC in it. Yeah. It's also got the Eula Plus as well, which I know Chris, wasn't it Chris Smith that developed the Eula Plus? He's now
I think it part might have games. Been. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure he was.
He might well have been. I'm not entirely sure. Admittedly, I've never been too keen because the colours look a bit dull to me. But
okay, you know, right, it's right.
For a lot of people, they'll be experiencing that for the first time. And it might bring something new for them, and they might enjoy the games looking that way.
They've done their own ROM as well, haven't they? Because they can't bundle ROMs with it.
Yeah, it's not allowed to say Sinclair Research on it because it's actually a Sinclair product.
Okay.
But it should be 100% compatible.
And you can load your own ROMs.
You can put the original ROMs on it, because
just great.
A lot of people will own the ROMs.
Of course. Somehow. And I think that's what rises it above maybe even like the C64 Mini in turning it, or C64, turning it into more of a deeper tool that it can load. You can have other ROMs in it, so you can have...
Yeah, apparently you can do it with the C64 as well.
Oh, can you?
Yeah, apparently.
Right, okay.
That's what I read a little while ago. So
yeah, there was something about that. So I've had a go on that, and it didn't feel quite right as a product. It was nice. It was really good, but that keyboard didn't feel like the original keyboard, which is, you know, is no bad thing in the grand scheme of it. But at the same time, it just lacked a little bit of authenticity. I don't know. There was something about it. Worked really well as a mini, and I've still got my C64 Mini. I think it's a great little bit of kit for chucking.
See, I wasn't keen on the minis because you've got to add the keyboard, and I just think it becomes a bit of a mess on your desk.
True.
I like the small form factor of them. I wish, in a way, that they would sell empty versions of them, and I could just have them on a shelf, because I think they look nice.
Well, to be honest with you, they're so cheap now, you can probably get one and put it on a shelf anyway.
You can get them cheap.
But I don't know. If this feels nice, on, you know, with the rubber keys, I think they're going to have replicated it as best as they can. I think this is going to be a nice product. So, yeah. They are delivering on their promises, unlike certain companies out there. Yeah. And I think they're continuing, the 400, the Atari 400 recently as well.
Mm-hmm.
And... rumour, or no, they've confirmed that there'll be a big Amiga coming, isn't
there? There will be a bigger Amiga, yeah.
Which will that's be nice the one
when
me.
It comes. Yeah, yeah, a lot of people were expecting that on this announcement from a few weeks back.
I think this feels a bit like it's definitely a really good product, but it feels like the stopgap to build up the coffers, and I mean that respectfully to Retro Games if they're listening, but it's to build up the bank balance to fund that Amiga. Do you know what I mean?
I don't know how popular our little tweet was that we put out. So, I think this will build up the coppers. Yeah.
Very popular in this country
and in Spain and a lot of other places as well.
Yeah. Is it going to be like a Russian clone of it that comes out?
They should do that, shouldn't they?
I had one of them once when I was doing the photography for Sam's Bitmap Books. he got me one of a Russian one to photograph, which was a really interesting bit of kit, but I did not plug that thing in. I was never going to plug that thing in. I didn't trust it. I like my house too much. It was a
Soviet spy machine that would blow your electrics.
Yeah, it definitely didn't look. It had some crazy connectors on the back of it, and the power connector didn't look standard to the UK. No. So I thought that's not as much as I'd love to see what it outputs. You know what the ROM is inside it. I ain't touching that thing. Yeah. Crazy. No, it's all good. I think it's going to fly off the shelves, the virtual shelves, the real shelves, whatever. It's going to fly off them, and it's going to do very, very well for them. And I just say mad props to them for doing this and continuing it. Because like you said, it's going to reach a new audience. It's going to reach the people who were into it before. And I think these kind of these kind of computers, but even the console ones, they reach people who were into it back in the day but have never stayed into it. So they might have got an Amiga afterwards, an ST, or they might have moved to the SNES or something. And that was it. Then they went into whatever, married life and had kids, and they don't think about it again. And now they're in their 40s, maybe 50s, 60s. They go, oh, look at that thing on the shelf. Oh, that looks wicked. Oh, look at them games. Oh, I'll have some of that. And suddenly you draw these people back in again, and you'll probably get those people going, I want to get a bit deeper into this as well.
Yeah. So, and it's a decent price as well. Just under 90 quid.
Is it?
You know, it's a stocking filler, I think. For a lot of wives will probably see that and mention it to their husbands and say, yeah, I want one. Or vice versa. I'm sure there's women who loved their Spectrums back in the day.
Of course. And little do they know what that will lead to after they buy it for them.
That's right. As long as they tune in to us, Matt, I don't care what they get up to.
Can we get this bundled with the in the box? Maybe get a flyer in there. Maybe we can tap them up for that. I don't know.
Yeah, I'll have to have a word. Talking of getting our name out there, did you listen to BBC Radio 2 the other night, Matt?
BBC Radio 2, Smashy. Lovely.
Not off. I did. It's one of your top 10 stations of all time.
Well, let's rock. I heard there were two very familiar voices on there, that's for sure. Tell us more, Ding. What happened?
Well,
how'd they let you in?
I got an email from one of the producers saying, Dean, we've been bugging you now for years. Please.
Was it Tony Blackburn with it?
It was, yeah. He's been bugging us for years. No, it was a lady called Sophie emailed me, and she invited us on.
Nice. And, so what was it about, and how the hell did people hear it?
Well, we're going to play the clip minus the music on this episode after we've spoken. It's OJ Borge is the DJ. He's on from midnight of a weekday till 2 in the morning, I think. And he has a little section on their Midnight Mastermind where they invite all different people on to ask him questions. And we got asked to submit some questions, which we did. The questions got rejected because they were too hard. They were ones that James came up with. And the producer suggested, can we just focus on one system? So we picked the PlayStation 2 because it's the biggest selling console ever. And I thought, he's got to know about that because it is into his game. And I've heard, because OJ does cover during the day sometimes, and I often have Radio 2 on because other stations that I listen to, because I drive all over the place, they cut out, whereas Radio 2, it covers the whole country. So I'd heard him mention gaming before in the past, and we decided to go with a PlayStation 2.
Nice.
Asked him a few questions. Some people think I was a bit soft with him with one of the answers.
Were you?
Not really. I don't think I was. He got it half right. And also there was another thing where he mentions about the PlayStation price. What is it he said? It's E3 where this was announced. Can you remember the guy from Sony walks on, says the price, and then drops the mic and walks off? It's the PlayStation 1, I think, rather than the PlayStation 2, which OJ thought it was. But he was called in the E3 show, CEX. And I didn't correct him on that either. Yeah. Anyway, should we play the clip?
Now.
Yeah.
Midnight Mastermind.
Brand new week. I mean, the scores sort of roll over. It's a continual scoring loop. On Friday... how did I do? I got a full house on Friday. The subjects last week were space security. That was very high. And Chicago Bulls, monkey puzzle trees. It was a full house with the latter. But we've reset the dial, I guess, in a way. Even though if I get a full house, I'll be claiming it as a 2 out of 3. Let's see who's asking the questions by saying, good morning, what is your name?
Dean Swain.
Dean, and I believe you're not on your own, Dean.
That's right, I'm with James Middleton from the Retro Asylum podcast.
Oh, okay, Dean and James. You tell me what that is in a second, but first, let me find out where in the world are you both?
I'm in Hertfordshire near Bishop Stortford.
Okay.
And I'm in Bristol.
Lovely. Any excitement for winter? What's the one thing from each of you that excites you about the cold months coming?
For myself, it's not sweating so much.
Dig that.
Oh, it's a tough one, isn't it? If you've got kids, then it's just sort of like 3 months of kids having colds in it. But I would say probably mince pies on the shelves.
Oh,
don't say the C word, though.
Don't say the C. Please don't. No one say the C word, please. Oh. Do you indulge in a mince pie before the 1st of December?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
it's been great having you on, guys. We'll see. I'm joking. Do you then before December?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Listen, I probably have done in the past. Anyway, what are we doing? What's the subject?
It's the PlayStation 2, which I know you're a bit of a fan of.
I am a fan. And remind me, what's the name of the podcast? Why are we doing this?
Retro Asylum. It's the UK's number one retro gaming podcast.
Oh, wow. Okay, I dig this.
Slick.
I love it. I love the idea of this. Tell me more about this in a second. I need to do some research on the PlayStation 2, which, of course, I may well have had. And then we'll do 3 questions on it after this. Oh, I feel like I needed more time here. Three questions on the PlayStation 2 is what we're doing with Dean and James from the Retro Asylum podcast. Of all the retro gaming things then, boys, why this, Dean? Why did you choose this as a great subject?
I've heard you mention it on the show when you covered during the day before, so I know you're a bit of a retro gaming fan.
Well, I'm a bit of a gaming fan full stop, but I think when you get to our age, and I'm sort of guessing at your age is slightly, if you're the same age as me, which is 45, I feel we've grown up with gaming. You know, my first computer was an Amstrad CPC 464 where we used to load games on a tape. I mean, I tried to say this to one of my kids recently. They were like, what's a tape? It's like, didn't go anywhere. When we first went to university and places like that, we had social gaming on PlayStations. And then now I don't see friends because I've got kids and a late night job. Now it's all about the internet. Yeah. So I just feel like it's been such a part of our lives since we were kids. It's just who we are.
Yeah. Well, this will definitely get you back to your roots.
What's the greatest game of all time?
Oh, it is a question. I love Double Dragon, which is an old arcade game. Mm. It's not the greatest game of all time, but it's one of my favourites.
What makes a great game? Because retro gaming, one of the problems I've always found is you go back and play them and they're just not as good as you remember them.
Oh, see, I find that the opposite. I don't know, I just love them. I love the old graphics, the old sound. The games can be completed fairly quickly. As someone my age, I'm 49, with 2 kids and a full-time job, I just don't get the time for modern gaming.
Yeah.
So the old games, they really do suit me.
Yeah, and what freaks you out nowadays with retro games is you get, like in the day you'd have like 3 games, wouldn't you? And you'd swap them with friends and they'd be expensive to buy if they were on cartridges. Nowadays you can buy preloaded ones which have got pretty much everything that's ever been released on.
Yeah. It's pretty mad. It's really a good time to be playing these games.
Yeah.
They're easy to obtain.
I agree with you. I tried to play Monkey Island again recently because it's on my phone. So I downloaded it on my phone. Did you ever play Monkey Island?
I did, yep.
Yeah. And I remember playing through it the first time because I was at school, and to cheat, somebody had printed out on a dot matrix printer, had actually printed out a load of hints. There was no internet back then, so that's the way that people gave you tips to get through it. Anyway, boys, I've gone off on a tangent. Let me set the mood.
Midnight Mastermind.
And I shall now hand over radio to you, to Dean and James of the Retro Asylum podcast, for me to attempt three questions on the PlayStation 2. My honour depends on doing well here, boys. So take it away. Ready.
Right, so the first question then was, the PlayStation 2 featured a heavily publicised and often overhyped processor that was co-developed by Sony and Toshiba. What was the name of that processor?
Ooh, I have got no idea, so let me take a guess. I'm sure I've heard it at some point. Oh, did you see it when it booted up? Was it in the boot-up screen?
No.
No, okay.
But it was so powerful, it was supposed to make you feel...
That's a heavy hint.
That
there,
is a very is, heavy yeah. hint. Is it? Was it called the emotion chip?
Emotion engine.
Oh, well, listen, you're in charge. Was that right or wrong?
You get half a point. Sure.
Half a point. Yeah. Half a point.
I'll take half a point. We don't have a sound effect for half a point, but I'll take it. How powerful was it?
Well, it was so powerful that there were stories at the time that Saddam Hussein had been stockpiling consoles to make a supercomputer.
But, yeah. Wow, that's going to take a lot of PlayStation 2s, would be my guess. Yeah. Right, okay, half a point out of one. Let's go question two.
Right, okay, the next question is, Sega released its last console a year ahead of the PlayStation 2 in late 1999. What was that console called?
That would be the... Okay. This was the time... This was proper console wars. This is when everyone was trying to get that market. It was... the Dreamcast?
It was indeed. Well done.
There you go. Right. Did you... Either of you have a Dreamcast?
Yes.
Yep, still got one, yeah.
I never got into the Dreamcast. Anyway, final question.
Right. So, what PlayStation 2 snowboarding game featured music... from Run DMC.
I spent my entire life on this game. I still, to this day, say it's one of the greatest, most addictive games that's ever come out. My character of choice was Moby. The moves you could do were insane. I had a mate of mine who spent most of his time on his own sofa, who set a high score that none of us could get within a million points of. That game is SSX Tricky.
Nice. Yeah.
Right.
What a game that is. Have you played it recently?
Yeah. I still enjoy it.
Well, the third one's it's backwards compatible on the Xbox as well. So
no. Yeah. Oh, I might have to get that. Do you know, a mate of mine was telling me a story about the PlayStation 2 recently, and you could maybe tell me if this is true or not, or I've got the wrong console. And at the time, they were going to CEX, which is the big technology festival, which is in Las Vegas, where everyone announces their new products. And all the other, you know, I think Xbox had come on and all the different, you know, Nintendo had come on, all the different console makers had come on stage, and they talked about the power and the games and what it could do. And the guy from Sony walked on stage, went $299 and walked straight back off again because it's always been a price war.
Yeah,
that's true.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Love it, the fact when I tell a story and it's actually true and it's not made up in my brain. Boys, I love that. 2.5 out of 3 I'll take. Just tell people about the Retro Asylum podcast. Where can people find it? What can they hear when they listen in?
You can find it pretty much anywhere you download your podcast, even the smart speaker if you ask to play Retro Asylum. It's all about video gaming from the late 70s up until really the early 2000s.
I love it. I'm going to tune in. Thank you so much, boys. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for having us on.
And I've just seen the track that Sophie's put in. I like this. There you go. 2.5 out of 3 on retro gaming, well, on the PlayStation 2 from the Retro Asylum podcast. I'll take that 2.5 out of 3, and look what it is.
Listen to that, Dean. You on BBC Radio 2, and Jim, of course, as well. Fair play to you both. All good, that is. All good.
It was. And we had to do that live. I stayed up. I had to take the next day off, holiday, because I'm normally up at 10 to 5 of the morning.
Mm.
And, we was on at 12:30 at night. It took about 15 minutes to do. So, I was a bit knackered. And I did actually get quite sweaty palms just beforehand. I got a bit nervous. And so did Jim, funnily enough. But I said to Jim, look, you've only just joined Retro Asylum and you're already on Radio 2 with us. How bad's it?
Yeah, that's right. Oh, so if there is a glory hunter, he's it. It's not me anymore.
He's it. He jumped on because I feel quite bad because Mark Kitt, he offered to do it. But I thought with it being Radio 2 and the time it was going out, it might be better if it was a UK person. That sounds even more racist, doesn't it, really?
You're digging a hole, Eddie. Yeah. You need I'll that Hoover that sat behind you to get yourself out of it, mate. Keep going. I'm enjoying this.
Sorry, Mark. You're American. That's why I went with Jim instead.
Listen, Mark, if he's listening to this, all he needs to do is go back to some of the first episodes I was on, and I was very uncomplimentary of the US folk.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
you're not even close, Dean.
Oh, wow. That's good.
No, that's good. Right. I mean, that's great exposure. It's nice to get recognised. You know, you're invited on to Radio 2, not the other way around.
That's it. And as soon as I spoke to the producer, because we had to do a test at 10:30 the night before, and I was speaking to her, and I said, when are we getting our own regular slot? Which she found quite funny. And the funny thing was, as you just heard, as soon as I got on, I mentioned Retro Asylum. OJ asked me, who's he got on? And I said my name and Jim's name, and I said, we're from the Retro Asylum podcast. I just wanted to plug it.
Get it in there. Absolutely, mate.
And, yeah, listeners, if you do want us on Radio 2 in our own slot, please send the BBC press office loads of messages, and you never know. It might happen.
You never know.
We have been invited back, so we could be back on there at some point. And we might have OJ on this show as well. So.
Oh, there you go, you see. Cross-pollination. Yeah, right. it can only mean good things. And Dean on National Radio. That. Yeah, well, Dean on National Radio is not a bad thing, mate.
Mm.
Because we need more Cockneys on Radio too, because the accent is very normal British Southern person. We need proper regional accents, and what better proper gritty, than an EastEnder?
Yeah, why not?
EastEnder going on there, proper EastEnder, not those fake ones on the TV show.
Right? No, exactly. All these Essex boys getting on the TV lately.
Yeah, they're not proper Cockneys, are they?
No, they're not proper Cockneys at all.
I am a more Cockney than an Essex person. Let's put it that way.
You are.
I live just the other side of London, so you know I'm not that far away. Not Slough.
It is Slough.
It's not Slough. I work in Slough. I live a little bit away from it. Right. What's the main event of this one then, Dean?
Right, the main event. Well, see, like we've been on the radio. Why not bring in a TV personality?
Oh, suits you, sir. Yes.
You know, we're really mixing with the cream now.
Yeah.
You've seen the cover. You've probably read the description if you haven't seen the cover. Mr. Jason Bradbury from The Gadget Show.
Fantastic.
And he is. Having spoke to him a few times now, we're best mates, as you will hear in the interview, really down-to-earth, nice bloke as well. I've got to admit, I never really used to watch The Gadget Show because during that time I was working nights, so it's not something I really caught. Obviously, I knew who he was. You know, I'd seen him on other things and what have you, but I didn't know what to expect, I've got to admit. And having spoken to him, really nice bloke.
Yeah, I was a big fan of The Gadget Show in the early days, in those days that he was on. When he left, you know, I ain't just saying this, I kind of dwindled lost away from it a bit. I did watch it, you know, because there was, you know, Otis Dealey carried it on as a girl I can't remember, and John Bentley, who we mentioned on the show. Yeah. They're all still really good, but there's just, as you'll hear in a minute, Jason's just got this wonderful energy, and it's infectious.
And he's very passionate.
That is.
Because a lot of the people on TV are presenting. That is their job, just to present, and they can do all different subjects. And I'm sure Jason can present other things, but he is genuinely passionate about technology and, luckily for us, retro gear as well.
Mm, Definitely, yeah. And it was a good couple of hours, wasn't it? And I don't know where it ended up in terms of time, but we spoke to him for a couple of hours and it flew by, and he was a consummate professional, as you'd expect, but like you say, just down to earth. And we had a chat, didn't we? We had a chat.
It was really good. I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
So let's get to it then. So coming up now, folks, Jason Bradbury, Dean Swain from Radio 2, and humble old Minnow here, Matt Wilshire.
From the Christmas tree box.
Yeah. Enjoy it, folks.
Hello, I'm Jason Bradbury, and I've got an incredible story that I need you to help us tell.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, Jason Bradbury. How are you, Jason?
I'm really good, thanks. Well, I'm really excited to be invited into the Retro Asylum. It's so cool.
It's taken us a while to get you into the Retro Asylum this evening. So, you know, we've made it. And yeah. That's the first task done. It's an escape room now, basically. But for most of our UK listeners, they'll know you from The Gadget Show, I'm pretty sure. We've got a lot of overseas listeners as well. So, Jason, who are you? What's your name and where do you come from?
So I'm Jason Bradbury. I come from the 80s. And I come from the past in a DeLorean. And most people in the UK know me for a show that I did for 12 years on a TV channel called Channel 5, called The Gadget Show, which, as the name suggests, was all about testing cool tech at a time when no one was testing cool tech. You know, then Top Gear was a thing, which even your international listeners will be familiar with. And I think it's fair to say, based on the fact that most of our production team were ex-Top Gear people, The Gadget Show is the kind of Top Gear of tech, isn't it? That's kind of what we do. So we don't just do the kind of consumer reviews. In fact, we do that, but we also did that sort of bonkers high concept stuff that the Top Gear, certainly in its latter years, the Top Gear team were famous for. So, you know, races across the Brecon Beacons to test out tents, walking boots, you know, torches. A torch so hot, I remember testing, I fried an egg on the lens. Stupid stuff that we did, you know, races on bonkers electric skateboard vehicles and then jumping onto, you know, some tricycle and going across London. Who can beat a London cabbie to the destination? Those sorts of high concept ideas. But within that was a consumer review of something that people were interested in. And at a time when you couldn't watch it on YouTube because YouTube didn't exist.
Yeah, it was great. I remember watching it, if not from series one, then definitely from series two. And it was always something that I'd record religiously on good old Sky Plus back in the day. So it was great. And it was you, John Bentley, and there was a third
Susie presenter. Perry was the...
Of course, Susie Perry, yes.
I know. The amazing Susie Perry, who, and this is not meant to be a plug, but I was actually working with today in this very studio, because we were recording the second series of our own podcast, which is called The Gadget Show Podcast. So some of your listeners, even the real Gadget Show aficionados, because there's so much great content around now, isn't there? They might not be aware that we're doing that. We just started the second series. And John was a guest, actually, today. So how weird is
lovely.
That? Yeah. We had another presenter, you know, at the beginning of that series one called Adrian. I forget his surname, a guy called Adrian. So it was me, John Bentley, this guy Adrian, and Susie Perry. That was actually the first lineup just for the first series, and then it changed for the second series, and it was just the three of us.
It was great, and you had the massive competition in the middle of it, which kind of went on for 5 minutes while you were going, and a PS3, and a Xbox, and a new mobile phone, pre-iPhone, actually. You know, it's probably a Nokia of some sort.
It would have been a smartphone, a Nokia N95 or something.
95,
yes. It looks like Dean actually won one of the Gadget Show competitions. I don't know if... listeners have ever been described.
It looks like the Gadget Show set, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, no, you know what? It really does look like the set for kind of bad influence or like a 90s kids.
Andy Crane's hiding show. Around the back.
I was going to say, I'd prefer if it was Violet Berlin, but yeah. Set for Andy. No, it's great. So I'll describe, Dean, I'll describe it. You've got the... is that the one-up version of the Star Wars cap?
That's the one-up version. It's modified, though, so it's got a different...
Jason, you've just given the game away. He was saying it was an original cabinet to all the listeners until that point.
Not unless everyone's really small. No, this is a waterfall...
it's beautiful, though, mate.
...control panel. So it's slightly different to what you're buying the shops. I've spent.
So you've modified that then, because it looks looks totally like the only reason I knew that, Matt, was because Dean and I chatted the other day. That's the only reason I knew. And he's also got two cabs next to it.
These are your old fish and chip shop style cabs. There's two of them.
Oh,
there.
So yes.
Got one vertical, one horizontal. Yeah, they're running MAME on Raspberry Pis, but they do me.
Mate, you've done a great job there.
So, and they've got CRTs in them as well.
Have they really? So none of this sense CRT. Although I do quite like the Raspberry Pi CRT emulation stuff that you can do. You know,
yeah,
the way that
it's looking pretty good now.
Yeah.
The Star Wars has got an LCD in it, but the other two are CRTs, so...
No, we did that thing a number of years ago, wasn't it, Dean? The RGB Pi, which was outputting from that GPIO slot to
you
SCART,
could plug it into the SCART socket on a TV, which was
really
good.
It's really good. It was really, really good. Our CRT, it looked beautiful because it was RGB, wasn't it? And I was only ever used to the old output. Mm. We digress.
If we're on CRTs, the old cathode ray tube, I do have a bit of a fetish for that. You will probably not be surprised to learn that I'm a little bit of a hoarder. and given access to the kind of stuff that I got access to, because that show, as you know, was big at one point. It was really big. And, I had the money to buy stuff. I mean, I went from everything from, synthesizers. I had a considerable collection of 80s synths, which we were talking about earlier, Matt.
Highly jealous of.
Oh, well, mate, unfortunately, I've sold most of them now. Yeah. But it even stretched to a DeLorean.
Wow.
Yeah.
I bought a DeLorean. Wow. I bought a DeLorean from a guy in Northern Ireland, weirdly enough. It was one of the few DeLoreans that never made it across the pond to America. And then over the period of about 3 months, with some friends of mine that actually, by luck, have a metalwork factory. Would you believe that? We converted it into the time machine and got all the time circuits. And I'm not being silly. I'm being serious. I mean, as in a prop, as in a beautiful, movie-accurate time machine variant of a DeLorean. So that's possibly the most exotic thing. And I'd like to have that in the background, Dean, because that would trump...
That would be love. Yeah, that would outclass this, that's for sure.
But at the moment, you're definitely winning, mate, with that backdrop.
Wow. That's nice of you to say so, but I've seen some of your room. You showed me you got the Sinclair C5 in there, and
I have, in fact, in front of So I don't know if listeners are aware, the Sinclair C5, 1985, from Sir Clive Sinclair or Sinclair Research, to be precise. He was always obsessed with. I'm telling you guys know all this stuff, but he was obsessed with making a car, wasn't he? And and in the end, because he was very focused on consumer grade stuff, that's why the old white clean keyboards on the ZX80 and the rubber keyboard on the famous ZX Spectrum. There you go, the ZX81 as well.
Yeah,
ZX81.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, Dean's holding up a nice, beautiful chiaroscuro, posh Italian word for black and white. ZX81. And so when he came to actually make a car, it actually turned out to be a much more affordable, future-gazing electric vehicle. And I've got one, as Dean said, here, because I was doing some filming with it. I've actually got my tripod on it, which is a bit weird because I couldn't put the camera on it. So. And what I think about that is interesting. I don't know what you think to this, Matt. I'm going to pitch this idea to you. What if we were to do a Kickstarter now? And you pitch something like a three-wheeled recumbent bicycle chassis with a futuristic surround thing with maybe a rain cover and a boot and an electric engine. I reckon you'd get it funded. What do you think?
Well, you never. That's not what you're on here pitching, is it, Jason?
No, it's not. It's not. It's not. But it's an interesting idea. What I'm saying is the guy was way ahead of his time.
Oh, he was way ahead of his time.
Yeah, I mean,
with that.
That said, you had Milk Floats, the original electric vehicle from my memory. Then you had the C5
85. And very similar performance.
Yes.
In the drag race.
But you know what? That C5, it was way, way ahead of Elon Musk and his empire. I think just Sir Clive Sinclair was too far ahead because the technology wasn't there. He used a Hoover manufacturer, as we well know, called Hoover, or a vacuum manufacturer, should we say, for the American
consortium.
And it just wasn't. It was one of those pioneering moves that was too far ahead of its time. The technology was way back there somewhere, and it was never going to work. But God bless people who do that, because you need folk to do that to make that step forward at some point.
You made the connection to Elon Musk, and it doesn't matter what people think about Elon Musk, because he's a divisive character, but you'd be an idiot if you didn't recognize that he's one of the most pioneering, you know, innovators of not just new tech, but new tech systems, you know, that we've ever had historically, you know. And I would say that Sir Clive Sinclair, with all of his personality quirks, you know, was a real pioneer. And yeah, and were he around now, he'd be producing an AI watch, or he'd be doing something, you know, with electric vehicles that is unique. He'd probably be looking at an affordable way of kind of like a personalized flying drone or something like that that flies you around. He was amazing. And that's why we loved him. You know, that's why when you hold that machine up like you just did, Dean, you know, we have respect. It's like that. There's not. I won't let a bad word be said about that kit, because it was game changing at the time, and it's
absolutely
still beautiful.
I mean,
emotional design.
Absolutely, and people forget the Zeich. You know, the first electric bike, or certainly tried to again consumerize an electric bike, and again, just far too ahead of his time.
Yeah, no, amazing. I remember my dad in the 80s used to do consulting to various companies regarding plastics. So he was a plastics expert. I mean, he was actually the sales director for a plastics company, but he had a great deep knowledge of plastics and materials and that. And I remember him bringing home the Sinclair watch. And I remember bringing home other Sinclair products, prototypes from all kinds of different manufacturers from the first wave of the 80s consumer electronics generation. And I got access to so much of that kit. It was an amazing time, you know. In fact, it was kind of similar to now, actually, with the way now that there is such a diverse range of different pieces of tech. It's a bit like the 80s. In fact, there's a reason, isn't there, why in popular culture the 80s is so beloved of movies and TV and you know, and music now, because we're living in a similar age.
Yeah, yeah. It's very true. It's very true. And AI, big for you, which we'll come on to in a moment.
Oh, yeah,
so,
please.
You know,
so good to tell you. So keep listening, folks.
Why are you
really
here?
Cool to
why are you here? Yeah, this is going to get
good.
Should
we do it now? Should we get it done and over with? And then you can ask me. I think you can ask me about the Gadget Show competition. okay. So, yes. Well, I'm making a movie, Matt and Dean. I'm making a film. And you might think, why is that bloke off the Gadget Show making a movie? Well, the truth is that before I was on the Gadget Show, many years before that, I did a film degree, film and TV at Bristol Uni. And my contemporaries in my class and on the university course were the likes of Simon Pegg, David Walliams. I was in a comedy double act with David Walliams for many years. We were best mates, and various other people. Dominic Diamond, who auditioned down in London while we were all working together, got the job on Games Master and used to travel up and down between his student digs and London filming the Games Master. So, yeah, we were making films, playing with editing. I mean, we even edited on film. That's how old I am. Mm. We were still doing celluloid splicing when I did my film degree. We were also starting to work on Avid systems and things that used, well, magnetic tape, but we were splicing 16 mil film and learning the fundamentals. And I've always had it in me, like that whole thing about narrative and about cinema. And I wrote a movie with another stand-up comic called Mark Felgate, who became a really good friend of mine. We worked on various TV shows together, TV pilots. I actually got him on the Gadget Show, you know. I got him on the Gadget Show years later, and he wrote some jokes for Robo Jace. Do you remember Robo Jace?
I do remember that.
That was a robot version. They were like, can we replace Jace? He's kind of annoying. Can we get a robot to do Jason's job? And so they wrote jokes for him. Some of the jokes he wrote.
Nearly done yourself out of a job there.
Yeah. And it was in the days when AI obviously didn't exist, and it was more chatbot kind of, you know, Stephen Hawking style voice. It didn't go down. Because obviously people that go to a comedy club, by the time he got on stage, it was like 11 o'clock. They're all pissed. They weren't bothered about how cute the idea was. They were just shouting, get off, you know. But anyway, well, I digress. This is a guy called Mark Felgate. He's a stand-up comic. He's also in a double act called Men in Coats. And they've done, I think they did Britain's Got Talent. They've certainly done Italy's Got Talent, I know that much. And they're very successful. They do big gigs, big corporate gigs. Anyway, we wrote a movie about 10 or 12 years ago, right? And it was about golf. Again, why? Because I grew up playing golf, not playing golf, caddying down the local golf club in Lincolnshire, getting treated like SHIT by all the posh golfers, but earning good pocket money, right? And I always thought it was funny. And then one of the things that they did was they used to do these competitions, right? I promise you, this is all going to make sense. It sounds so random, it will make sense. They used to do these competitions, right? A couple of times a year, where they'd get a local business like a car dealership to sponsor a hole, and they'd have a competition and all the golfers would come and they'd have a big dinner and all that. And if you got on, let's say, for example, you got a hole in one on the 18th, then you'd win a car, right? Because no one's going to get a hole in one on the 18th, statistically. So they put these cars, but they'd have the car there. And sometimes they'd like put it up on a big platform and stuff like that. And I'd be caddying, you know, because I could earn lots of money in these competitions. They'd give you a bit of a bonus. Anyway, I came up with the idea, right, that two losers from Lincoln, basically me and my mates, it was a movie idea, right, come up with a plan to train a bird to catch a ball in midair, drop it in the hole, win a Bentley. it was called Pigeonholed, because obviously the double entendre there, it's also referring to the fact that they were pigeonholed by everyone in their town as losers, but actually they kind of go through that kind of hero's journey. Do you get what I mean? And so it's a comedy set in Lincolnshire, feature film. Oh my God, we couldn't get anyone to read it. I tried to go around to like Working Title, you know, that made the Notting Hill films and all that lot.
Yeah, yeah.
And Soho production companies. It's such a closed shop, guys. Such a closed shop. Anyway, about 2 years ago, Mark, my co-writer, who I've continued to be in touch with and work with in various ways, including getting on The Gadget Show, he became really ill. And he had some weird disease. I don't know what it... I think it was the one that... what's that pop star kid called? Justin Bieber had it, I think. And it affected his face. And his face went all lame, right? Well, my...
Bell's palsy.
It's something like that. And forgive me, because this is a serious condition. I don't mean to make light of it. And I don't mean to mispronounce it or anything like that. He had something like that. And it affected lots of things, but also affected his lungs. So he couldn't breathe properly, right? And he was in serious trouble. He was in hospital for a long time, right? And I used to ring him a couple of times a week. And every time I talked to him, I'd said, mate, when you get over this, we're going to write a second movie and we're going to get it made. He got over it. We've written the movie. It's called Control AI Delete. And it launches on Kickstarter on the 27th of February. Okay, and so that's what I'm here to talk. I'm here to talk about whatever you want, but that's one of the things that you were keen to question me on. So, do you want me to tell you about the story behind it?
Yes, please.
So, yes, absolutely. And you've already touched on something there, Jason, around being a closed shop in that industry. So hence why Kickstarter, I presume.
Yeah, so that was the idea, you know, to answer the exam question, how do we get around the issue that no one wants to even read the script, let alone back it? And also the fact that a lot of people, like, you know, you might know Stuart Ashens, a lot of people have demonstrated that you can, if you've got access to a small but passionate community of people, do amazing things like make games, publish books. There's loads of books that have been published in the retro gaming community in the last few years.
Indeed.
Yeah. And it wouldn't have been the case, would it, 5 years ago?
No.
Because mainstream publishers wouldn't even give you a look. And, you know, unless you ticked a commercial box for whatever is hot in publishing that year, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And let's be honest, creatively, that's not where the good stuff comes from. The good stuff comes from someone taking a risk, effectively sticking two fingers up to the norm and saying, I'm going to do this because I love it, right? And that's the same in music with the Sex Pistols or New Romantics or, you know, kids from Brooklyn spinning on a piece of lino, you know, in a New York street. This is where it comes from, right? And games, indie games that just smash it because they're just unique. And I really do hope, you can't predict, but I hope that what we've got in Control AI Delete is something a bit like that. And this is the story in a nutshell. This is us in an elevator. I'm giving you my pitch, right? A bunch of retro gamers, all right, are at their annual beloved retro gaming festival in Skegness at an expo center, right? At the same time that weekend, it just so happens, there's a global rollout of an AI, all right? We've learnt about it in news broadcasts and on the front of the newspapers in the local petrol station and stuff in the beginning moments of the film. We know it's coming. It rolls out on the same day that they're at the expo, right? And all that happens is instantly the AI goes wrong. There are global blackouts. There's no electricity. There's a run on the banks. The stock markets are in free fall. People start rioting. They've got no food, no transportation. The looters come out. It gets a bit purgy on every city street in Europe and the Western world. Our gamers are safely ensconced with their generator, right? Kind of blissfully, they're not unaware of it, but they're blissfully unbothered by the descent into chaos around them, right? But then they realize that in the halls where all the retro vintage hardware is kept, right, might just be a few 80s and 90s computers, a bit like the one that Dean just held up and the ZX Spectrum I've got in my hands right now. There might be the solution you need to hack the AI and save the day. And that's the concept of Control AI Delete.
Cool. So it's a satirical take on AI by the sounds of it.
You better believe it. Nothing works, right? Even before the AI is rolled out, it's like there are little Easter eggs, little winks. There are little cues that everyone will understand about nothing working, about how everything requires, 87
firmware
lines.
Firmware update.
Again?
A firmware update.
Everything requires a firmware update. Everything requires personal information, and nothing truly works, especially if you're a bit of an early adopter. That's the other thing, isn't it? And there's loads of stuff going on that suggests this. In a little bit like the way, I mentioned Simon Pegg earlier, but I suppose it's a little bit like in the early stages of Shaun of the Dead, we as viewers are aware because we see a news, I think there's a newspaper thing or whatever, and you know that an asteroid has landed. There's something like that, I seem to remember.
Yeah.
But things happen in the background, like someone bangs into someone and they get dragged through the front of the car. But it's just as Sean is in the, is in the off license and he bends down to pick something up. So he misses out what's going on outside, mayhem. Mm. It's a bit like that. So yes, it is very, very much a kind of overt comment on the state of the modern tech world.
So what is it about AI that drew you into bringing this into a satirical take on it? Do you have a passion in it? Do you dislike it? Are you worried about it? What's your head at with that, Jason?
It's a really good question, actually. I earn a living because of AI. So the reason I was able to leave the Gadget Show, which I left after 12 years, just, to spend more time with my kids and have a more wholesome existence down here in Cornwall rather than flying every other week and living in London. The reason I was able to do that is because I was developing quite a healthy public speaking career. So most people know what TED is or a TED speech is. It's that sort of thing that I do, but I do it for companies and I would do it all over the world, but generally in the UK. So it might be a big event for a marketing conference at the NEC or something, and they'll want someone that's a bit interesting, has got some cool stuff to talk about. And generally I talk about transformational technologies. So I might talk about energy, retail, virtual reality, automation, things like that. But in the last 18 months, it's been nothing but AI, AI, AI. So I've schooled myself on AI. I did a course at MIT, believe it or not. I've always been quite bookish. I've been quite academic. I did well at university and all that sort of stuff. And because I like reading and I like theories. I'd kind of read a lot about the coming AI age, even before I think the real game changer happened, which was, I would argue, OpenAI's ChatGPT 3.5. That large language engine really woke everyone up to the fact that this wasn't just some dumb Siri or, Alexa. This was something different, and it answered it in a different, congruent and convincing way, right? And then now we're up to GPT you know, 4.5 or Omni or whatever it's called. And it's fascinating. And now you've got the, you know, the few days ago, guys, the rollout of one of, arguably one of the first major hardware devices that can boast AI on device, which is where it's all going at the moment. And we're really starting to see things shift. So yeah, I have a real fascination with it. I wouldn't say I've got a love for it because it scares the bejeebies out of me. Because you've only we were brought up on Terminator, weren't we? And war games. So, and there's a reason. Isn't there a reason why those kind of fireside chats have such an impact on us? You know, which is effectively what a movie is, isn't it? It's like the tribe sitting around the fire discussing, you know, the implications of going to the edge of the forest. You know, and it's fascinating, but really scary.
This is Nancy at Chase headquarters. We have an emergency here. Carlos, the New York armed robber, has been seen listening to Retro Asylum without leaving a review on iTunes. Over.
Leave it to us, Nancy, baby. Let's go, Mr. Driver.
If you really enjoy the Retro Asylum podcast show, then please leave us a review on iTunes.
All right, Jason, so where can everyone go? Let's do the admin on this. Where can everyone go to find this film, your film, and back it? And what's the perks you get with backing it?
Oh, thanks for asking that, man. That's the important thing, ultimately, isn't it? Look, if you want to get behind this, what I will say is it's a proper grassroots project, all right? And even to make the trailer, which you can probably see on my social media, it's my name generally, you know, Jason Bradbury on X or whatever. X is probably the best place. You know, the trailer that I'm showing is only 40 seconds long. It's a teaser trailer, really. But when you go to the full Kickstarter, if you're there on day of launch, which is the 27th of September, 2024, you'll see the full 4-minute trailer, which obviously, because we've not shot the movie, what we did was we decided to just take two scenes, really simple scenes, shoot them with our lead actor, who's a rather trained actor that we've already cast, right? And some thugs, like my mate who works behind the bar at my local pub, no joke, and some other mates, a couple of bandanas that we bought off Amazon. And we got the Sinclair C5 in there because that is a pivotal piece of action in the actual film. We shot some just taster footage, right? But we got a cinematic lens, right, called an anamorphic lens, which you might be familiar with. You'll certainly be familiar with how it looks. It's what make Blade, you know, it makes Blade Runner and Die Hard look like they do, right? Even though the movie's set in the modern day, we give a big nod to the nostalgic comedy action capers of the 1980s and 90s, right? So you'll see that, the 4-minute trailer's there. You'll be able to look all the way down, read all about it, meet the director. We've got a Hollywood director. Just as luck would have it, my mate Elizabeth went off to LA 10 years ago, started directing feature films, right? Relatively low budget films, but she's very accomplished and she's a great director. She's coming. Basically, we're all working for free sandwiches and accommodation. That is literally it, right? And our Kickstarter goal is not very high. We just need to get enough money to make the thing. And so you'll be supporting something really special. And the way to do it is probably the easiest thing to do is go to controlaidelete.net. That's CTRL as it's spelt on your keyboard. controlaidelete.net. And then there's loads of information on there. But whenever you see a Kickstarter logo, click on that and it'll take you through to the Kickstarter. And the perks, you asked about the perks, so many cool things. I'm looking at you, Dean. You can buy a role on screen. You his face. You can buy an opportunity to be an extra in the riot scenes. It's called Riot Star.
Well, that would suit me down to the ground. So, yeah, can be in.
I can see him being intimidating, Matt. Do you know what I'm saying? I can see.
Dean, well, it's all in the accent, mate. You know, that's what it is. Yeah. You don't mess with Dean.
Typecast with the Cockney accent, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll talk to our casting director about you. You can buy, though, unless you've got Dean's agent, you can buy an opportunity to be in the movie. And it's not mad money. Because what you've got to realize is what we're trying to do is put perks together that, you know, represent really good value for money. Obviously, you know, for the right reasons, cost us the least amount of money to produce so that we can maximize your investment to make the movie, right? Mm. And something like having a role on the movie, that's a great one.
That's pretty cool, isn't it?
Oh, that's mate.
That's great.
And you're getting the credits. You're getting the credits. There's other cool things. I'll tell you an absolute beauty that I reckon your retro gaming community listeners and viewers and so on will really appreciate. And it's called High Score Hero. Now, at the center of the movie, so I didn't get into any licensing issues, I created my own fictional arcade machine, which has a big history in the movie. The main character's dad is back in the 80s, was the world champion on this particular game. It's called Star Dash. And we've actually built all the livery for it and the marquee and everything, right? Because we needed that for the trailer. When you see the teaser trailer, or the full trailer, if you go to Kickstarter, you'll see the machine in action, right? I say in action, it's a dummy machine, but we do a pretty good job of making you think it's
making
real,
it
right?
Look real, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, High Score Hero, which is one of the perks, will mean that you get your name in the High Score Honor Roll on the screen. And we listen to this, but listen, in the small print, this is really funny, right? It says, we guarantee you that your name will be in at least one frame. There are 24 frames in the second. So look, before anyone gets disappointed, that's so that I can legally say, look, you're definitely going to be on screen and you're going to be able to pause the vid and you're going to be able to find your name. But the truth is, honestly, as I stand here, you might even be up there for 30 seconds because, you know, it's just that I need to guarantee that just, I think it's 100 people. Don't kill me if I've got this wrong. I'm sure that we only did it for 100 people. We might open it up to another 100 later on in the Kickstarter run. Mm. But it's a very limited edition thing. It's not very expensive. I don't want to give away the prices yet, but it's not very expensive. But my God, what do you think to that? For the retro gaming
crowd.
Cool.
It's brilliant. And you know what? That harks back to Bad Influence again with a data blast at the end where you'd have to pause to get cheats the game. So this is that all over again, isn't it?
Dude, please remind me. That's a great thing. I need to put that on the Kickstarter because that is true. That is exactly what it is. We're harking back to those days. In fact, a lot of the truth is a lot of people do it with Patreon, don't they, in their YouTube videos now. And, you know, they sort of cavalcade of names come down the screen, right? We'll make sure, you know, if you buy one of those coveted High Score Heroes perks, you'll be on that screen. And it'll be cool because you'll be in the back. You might be in the background while one of the characters is chatting, yeah? And you'll just be like, oh, look, that's my name. Or it might be right in the main scene. That, you know, I don't want to give too much away, but you can probably guess that said arcade machine is pretty pivotal to the narrative, goes right through to the end. Can he do it? I'm just saying that and nothing more, right? Imagine if your name is there. It'd be so cool, man. It'd be so cool. And then you've got Blu-rays, signed things, props, wicked T-shirts. Wicked T-shirts. Yeah. I'm wearing one of them.
Very cool.
On the back, it says, because I know most of your crowd are listening, so I'll tell you what it says. It says, AI stole my job and all I got was this 1,000 T-shirt.
Love
very
it.
Good.
There you go. So there you go. So you've been very generous. I should really move on now because I don't want to outstay my welcome. Thank you so much for letting me talk about that. So now ask me anything else.
Well, anything you thank want. You for explaining it. It sounds brilliant. You know, let's just chop you there and say thank you, Jason. That does sound like a proper Brit film. You know, it's a Brit
film.
Yeah, clearly.
It is.
And you're even just explaining it, you're capturing that vibe and culture that we love and the listeners are going to love. But, you know, we talk about that so much when we're chatting together we're on Telegram together. And when we talk on the shows and we have our Christmas show, which is always a real, like, it's a festive feature of 8-bit wars, 16-bit wars. If you could bottle the vibe of that time and that era, you would do it. And it sounds like you're doing a lovely little time capsule and a love letter to that past, but keep it with the AI piece.
Yeah. So we're taking
slap bang up to date.
That's what it was. It was a kind of answer to an exam question, right? I'm mindful that I just keep talking about this. So do forgive me. but it is an answer to an exam question. You know, how can we talk about something? How can we talk about retro gaming within a movie narrative set in the modern day? That's what it was. Because there's a lot of 80s movies that, you know, movies that are set in the 80s. I mean, Stranger Things being, you know, the obvious example. Obviously, it's a TV show, but you know what I mean. I wanted to use 80s aesthetics and themes and sensibilities, right, in a modern context, in a kind of almost kitchen sink, gritty British comedy. That was my exam questions. You get what I mean? And then it just dropped into our lap. The AI thing just made it possible.
And a great.
How long did it take you to write?
Well, the writing process is interesting. Yeah, again, forgive my indulgence, but it's a great question. And so I told you earlier that I'm quite bookish. I'm quite into reading and stuff, right? And I've, over the years, not just on my film course, but I read a lot about the process of film script writing and narrative, yeah? And it's very systematic. I know you guys will know this, but it is so systematic. It's ridiculous. I mean, I was on a train recently, right? I was having a conversation with a couple opposite me. They're asking me what I was doing. I was explaining I'm just doing this film and I'm trying to get it made and blah, blah, blah. And we got onto the formulaic thing, right? And I said, you know what? Here's a thing that you might not know. Most, by which I mean like 95% of all successful mainstream Hollywood films, those two things are important. It's got to be successful and it's got to be mainstream. And there's loads of examples that I could give you, but the one example I gave them, the opening scene is either exactly the same as the last scene or some kind of ironic reversal of it. Mm. And I said, tell you what, and I had my laptop on and I was about a quarter of the way through Top Gun Maverick, right? I said, look, I've not seen the end of this film, but I'm going to predict that the last scene is either the same or some form of abstract mirror of the first scene. So I turned the laptop round and I spooled it to the first scene. The first scene is Maverick in a hangar, right? And he's getting his leather jacket out of the wardrobe thingy, you know, the high school locker.
Mm.
And then I grabbed the mouse and I spooled to the end. And sure enough, it was exactly the same scene, except slightly different in, I think he puts his jacket back. Yeah. But if he doesn't, he's in the same room, which has not been there since that first scene at the beginning, you know, 2 hours earlier. And then his love interest and her daughter, I think, then arrive. So they move the scene on, but it's the same scene. And these people sat opposite me were amazed. Well, the answer to the question, Dean, is it took us about 6 months because it was very formulaic. And I think if you don't stick to a formula, I think you can get yourself into loads of rewrites and it would probably have taken a year. But because we had a very strict narrative formula that I was following, actually the process was quite quick. What we did was we wrote it like a story, like a kind of Bible, where we were just free to write anything that came into our heads. And then we kind of moved it around a bit like Post-it notes, in Word, but moving it around. Then we had the narrative structure. Then we started with, we use a piece of software called Fade In, which is quite an inexpensive piece of software. It's like Word, but it formulates what you write in standard Hollywood script format. So again, it takes a lot of the messing about out of it.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, man.
Very nice. Very, very nice. So, Jason, getting back to your childhood, when did you first start, you know, you're obviously passionate about technology. What got you into that originally?
Well, it was my dad. I mentioned my dad earlier, didn't I? Bringing home the, not the bacon, but the plastics. Yeah, you remember, yeah. So I had a Sinclair watch and I had a, you know, first calculator. I had kind of toys that were electronics that maybe no one else really had. My dad would go to shows in America and he'd come back with American electronics, stuff that we couldn't really get over here. First console I ever owned was an Atari 2600. That's a game changer. I mean, my God, that just from a product design point of view, that thing was like something out of an alien spacecraft, wasn't it? I mean, if you look at it now, I've actually got mine on the mantelpiece in the lounge because it just looks so goddamn cool, right? With the orange, it's got the orange line around it. Mm. It's a Woody, the one I've got. In television, B-17 Bomber, the first...
the digitized speech or...
Yeah, the speech synthesizer.
That's it. Yeah.
And then various computers... I mean, the ZX80, we had that. In fact, I think we soldered that together or we plugged it together.
Yeah, they used to come in kit form, didn't they? Originally, I think. Yeah,
the ZX80. Very 1970s design, that, even though it's obviously made in 1980, don't you think? Like something out of like a 70s.
It's 1999 sort of vibe to it. Yeah.
That white thing.
Yeah.
which was very unusual. And then all the Sinclair computers, so the ZX81, the Spectrum, and also I remember being really impressed, I was probably the only person, with the Philips G7000. Something about that I liked. I like the size of it. Silver, again, wipe clean keys, I think. I did some basic programming on that. And so that was my... And I had a... Do you know what? I'm going to lose the love of some of your listeners. I never had a Commodore 64 that I owned, but my mate... Yeah.
I'm a Spectrum boy.
And yeah, and we used to go around each other's houses and we would... play on all those systems, and it's just incredible. I mean, the very notion of scarcity is something that my kids have got three kids, teenagers, right? They do not understand what that means. They might be able to look it up in a dictionary and recognize the meaning of the word scarcity, but the concept, right, that a movie comes out in the cinema in America, we then wait a matter of months until it comes out over here. We then wait a year for it to come out on VHS. And then when you go to get it on VHS, you have to walk on your bike, walk or go on your bike, on your BMX, a mile down the road or whatever it is. And then it's out because Matey Boy's best mates wanted that film. And so they gave it to those customers first. And then 2 weeks after that, you finally get, the Goonies or E.T. or Alien or whatever it is that you're waiting for, Aliens. And the same with games, the notion that you waited, what was it? I mean, how many minutes was it to load a game off tape? I can't even remember.
Yeah. I mean, it's bonkers. We've all got these emulation handhelds. I'm holding one up on the screen now. And, I refuse to put whole ROM sets on. We don't promote that, obviously, and condone it. But I refuse to put that on for that very reason of if you've got so many games, you're never going to play them. Back in those days, we valued every single game, even if it was a load of crap, because it took ages to load and you couldn't afford anything else. And I think we live in quite a privileged society now that I know there's a lot of poverty going on, and let's not get into that. But, where folk like us who are not sort of poverty stricken, everyone's got everything at their fingertips.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And you're talking about that scarcity. Games was the same, took ages to load. You could only afford a couple. You might get one for your birthday and Christmas, and you'd treasure those games, wouldn't you?
You would, because you could only get one, two, maybe three if you were really lucky. I mean, that'd be pushing it. Because they were still quite pricey in relative terms. I'd like to do a little thing where I work out actually how much was, Manic Miner? Like, what was the price of it? Like, and what does that mean in 2024 money? But they weren't cheap, were they? I remember there were cheap games. Do you remember? You could get cheap ones in like the...
Yeah, your budget games.
Yeah, and you'd sometimes get a gem, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but often occasionally.
But often even then, even within the relative simplicity of even what would have been, the equivalent AAA titles back in 1983, right? You'd still know when you got a cheap one. You'd get a cheap one for like $1.99. You'd press play and it'd just be rubbish. And you'd be like, that, mate. But even getting it, I had to get on the bus and go about 6 miles to my local town, Horncastle in Lincolnshire, and go to Woolworths. Did they have the game that you were reading about in Crash? If they could get it for you, it would take 2 weeks. Like all of these things, the scarcity was a part of, it was of every experience. You'd watch Top of the Pops, wouldn't you? Or some cool show. I'm sure there was like a Soul Train show in the 80s, because I was more into hip hop and electro kind of rare groove and funk and that, right? I'd listen to it on, say, Robbie Vincent's Sound of Sunday Night on Radio 1. And then if I ordered it, it would take 2 weeks before I got it. Imagine now. What, a kid waiting 2 weeks to listen to the new Lady Gaga or whatever it is that they listen to. It would be nuts.
Yeah. It's
ordering from a catalogue. I used to order Atari 2600 games from the catalogue, and you'd wait 6 weeks for that White Arrow van to come along. And
yeah,
half the time they'd deliver a different game. It weren't even the one you ordered.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely, it's incredible where we've come. And It's very important to recognize it. And as we design things, make things, create things, I think it's also a great source of inspiration. So you were talking about the movie, very, very kind words, Matt. And you're right. There is a simplicity to the movie. And it's based in part in this concept of scarcity, of being able to cherish something that takes a while or is, in narrative terms, more straightforward. It hasn't got all the bells and whistles. And I think there's a lot of value in that. I just wonder whether, are there any examples of, you know, emulators or kind of retro-orientated gaming devices that have a sense of that rarity, that sort of rarity about them? Do you get what I mean? Where you, so you yeah, can't just play yeah, the game straight away?
So scarcity, it's more... Yeah, scarcity, but more around bringing you that whole vibe and feeling at the time as well. You know, if you could, I reckon you've hit upon a gap in the market there, Jason, already. So you better get that on Kickstarter really quickly. Yeah, so a little handheld device or a unit that you can actually load a game on.
I've got the Spectrum. Load it. I've got the Spectrum Next just over there.
Yeah, you can hook a cassette player up to that, can't you?
Yeah, I know that. You can also click a digital emulating mode on it, which I thought was epic. But I think they should have made it like you can't circumvent
bypass
it.
Yeah.
I know that the because you've got the Spectrum coming out by Retro Games, which is based on the 48K Rubber Key model.
Yes.
That's coming out in November. And I think that's going to have the same sort of option. You can, you'll be able to load games up and now, you know, you get the loading sound and the loading screen and it will take a few minutes for it to load up.
Quite funny, kid. Sorry, Matt, go for it.
No, I was just going to say, I think things are going to come full circle in some way, shape or form that we're going to treasure those things again, from be it using cash in shops to some degree to loading games. And I think there is a market for that. It's just whether, you know, in this busy world and hyped up world we live in, whether it's going to be a very, very niche product if that sort of thing does come out. So I think having the option there is nice.
Do you know the company Teenage Engineering? As a synth boy, I thought you might know them. Are you familiar with them, Dean? They make cool keyboards, like pocket-sized portable keyboards, and they've made like some kind of AI companion device as well recently. But it's a company like that I think would come up with, you know, a kind of a product based around scarcity and waiting to get the result, you know, and insist on that process. I do like kind of modern interpretations of retro gear. There's I forget what they're called, something like We Rewind or something, but they've basically emulated physically the Sony Walkman, the OG Sony Walkman. And it comes in that classic steel blue with the orange headphones. And I think it's also Bluetooth and it's got some connectivity. I think there's a really interesting kind of set of design ideas around recreating, you know, the scarce, precious hardware and software experiences of the 80s and 90s in modern tech.
I think you've got to look at the way there is the vinyl revival, be it whether see that as a trendy thing or not, and then cassette started coming up again. And these are formats that don't sound as good. All right, vinyl, this has a thing about it that sounds lovely. Cassette doesn't sound as good as anything else, but cassette started coming up on the rise again. And you look at it in the retro scene as well. I mean, we've had people on the show before. They're publishers, they're retro publishers now, so they're putting out new games for old systems. And they're doing physical products of this. And I think it's a romantic view, definitely. You've just mentioned this Walkman sort of recreation. It's definitely a romantic thing. It's never going to be mass market. Or it could be if you can get it into the likes of HMV or something like that. But there's going to be the desire there. And I think you both have teenagers. I don't know. I'm thinking as they get older, there's going to be a crave for them looking back to go, what did I miss out on? And what should I be looking at now? I don't know. I just think there's going to be a turnaround, and maybe AI could well be the thing that does it in some way, that people get so scared of it you want to regress back, you know,
or you know, some form of cloud connected VR helmet can do, you know, a really realistic and immersive rendering of a 1980s living environment, and you can just return there and just live in it. Because we're talking about doing it physically, aren't we? But actually, doing it virtually is so much more practical. What I mean? And you're familiar with AI, with VR and stuff, guys. I'm guessing that you've... Yeah, you're down with that. So I'm really interested in it. It feels like it just achingly moves forward. And that's why I'm never too mean about Zuckerberg, because I think, no, don't slag him off. Keep him happy, because he's almost single-handedly, you know, placing affordable VR in the hands of a lot of people. You know, when the likes of Apple drop a £3,000, albeit incredible piece of technology, the Vision Pro, good old Zuck brings it out for like, you know, less than 500 quid, the Quest 3. That when I used that, and I was actually using it yesterday, I was going to tell you this actually. I did a radio interview. This is so random, right? With BBC Radio Devon, right? And the guy, of all the things that BBC Radio Devon said, he said, "Can we do it in VR?" I was like, "Yeah." I kind of expected you guys to ask that, but not this dude. And no disrespect for the people of Devon, because clearly you're down with your tech and I have huge respect. And we met up in some chat room and it was hilarious. It was really funny. You're like two avatars chatting to each other. But all I'm saying is when I do my AI talks, actually, people, it depends on the client, right? But if they're quite open and there's a good vibe in the room and they're talking about it, They ask me, you know, what's the weirdest sort of thing that you think's coming around the corner, something like that. And once in a while, if it's the right environment, I'll tell them what I actually think. Whereas when I'm in the business mode, I'll just say something that they want to hear, right?
Yeah.
But what I really think is resurrection of your dead loved ones in VR is going to be a big thing, and relationships with your ideal partner are going to be a big thing, and I'm sure the latter. Most people listening to this podcast, watching it, will understand that, because you don't have to be into the tech to know that a certain industry that no one ever wants to talk about have a track record of innovating new technologies, right? Like VHS and DVD, and they will innovate if indeed they're not doing it already. VR and I believe that those two areas. Are going to be massive. And so within that kind of idea, going back to the 80s, having a kind of almost like a second life, no pun intended, which is set in the decade of the 80s and 90s, I think is a great idea. I love it. Yeah. I love that concept.
Yeah, I think someone has actually created a virtual reality arcade environment where you can walk up to the machines and play them in VR.
Yeah, so, it's been done. There are a couple,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, it's been done, hasn't it? Yeah.
And they actually, believe it or not, you load the ROMs in as well.
Right.
They're not just like, you know, quick hacks of, you know, Galaxian Alight games or Dug Dig. You know, it's actually Dig Dug and it's Galaxian. And you've got to get the ROMs and you load it in there. And I can't remember what it's called, but I've played around with it. There's another one, isn't there, called, is it Arcade Dreams? Quite a recent one, actually, which is more of a kind of... I'll just look it up, actually. It's more of a kind of narrative one. I'm sure it's called Arcade Dreams. It's, no, maybe not. I don't know. Anyway, I was playing it on my Steam Deck, which I do love. I've got a Steam Deck. And I then learned that they've made a full VR version of this. It's a kind of resource management game where you run an arcade. In fact, you run a laundrette, actually. You run a laundrette and you're not making enough money, so you buy an arcade machine. And then you realise that the arcade machine's doing quite well, so you buy more arcade machines after you've picked up loads of socks and stuff that people have left and taken out the rubbish. And eventually you end up having converted the laundrette into a fully fledged arcade. That's what it does. But you can now do that in VR. I've not tried it, but that's another one.
You know what? There's a laundrette down the road from me. I'm going to go and suggest that to them.
Guys, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was doing a podcast the other day and an idea occurred to me.
Yeah. I love it. Jason, I wanted to just come back to the movie once more because of my music interest here. Utah Saints are providing the soundtrack. Is that right? And...
Yes, so that's an exclusive. You just dropped that, Matt, and no one else knows that. And I don't mind because I love you guys and I was so flattered by being invited on. Yeah. So the listeners of this podcast are the first people to know that, 90s dance floor British legends, Utah Saints, are curating the music. So they're putting it together, and they're going to give that their rubber seal. And looking at loads of tracks, and they're going to match it to the edit when eventually we get to the edit. And they might just pop up on that 4-minute promo that I mentioned that you'll be able to see when the Kickstarter goes live on the 27th of September. Lovely. So that's cool.
Lovely.
And should I tell you how and why, how that happened?
Yeah, please, please. Yeah. Because that kind of legends to me. They're legends to me.
All right, get this, right. So Tim, DJ Tim from Utah Saints, was one of my best mates when I was at school. He didn't actually go to my school. He went to a different one. But we were kind of drawn together, him and his brother. I also used to, his mom was a dance teacher, and I was really into like street dance and breaking when I was younger. And we had a breakdance crew, and me and Tim and his brother John and some other guys from the area formed a breakdance crew. And we used to do battles and down the local youth club and stuff. And Tim was cool even then. Like, he was a real standout character. And was a kind of leading light of that kind of hip hop early electro scene, you know, get all the cool 12 inches and that. In fact, my first decks I bought off Tim, they were early Technics decks. They weren't 1200s, and I think he sold me those so he could afford to buy some Technics 1200s. And he became a really good DJ even then, right? Then I went off to university, and then effectively when I came back, he was on top of the pops. He'd met Jez and got a record deal, and and the rest is kind of dance music folklore, like history. So basically Tim and I have kept in touch whenever I'm up in Lincolnshire, and I like to go back often. We meet up for a coffee, and I mentioned the idea to him, and both him and Jez were instantly up for it, and they've been really fun to work with. But obviously the real work starts when we've funded the movie and we actually start producing it, and then it's going to be great because I'm going to get to see what they have to offer.
So when you say curating the soundtrack, you're looking at tracks that have come before and now, or is there going to be exclusive tracks?
It's a really good, great question. You noticed that, right? You noticed that careful wording, right? Okay. So what I can't say is that they're going to create brand new tracks, right? Because I don't know yet whether we can do that or not. Because there's so much complex licensing and legalities around intellectual property, as you boys know, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if they create a track, like they can make a track, so here, Jace, use that in the arcade scene, right? Cool, I'll do that, yeah? Then let's say that we make the movie and we're fortunate enough to sell it to a streaming service, for example, yeah? Suddenly the streaming service are like, oh, where's the license for that? And I'm like, oh, well, that was just my mate. It's Tim, isn't it? It's cool. And they're like, no, we need the full license. So then what about his record company? And the record company about, what's this? We weren't aware you were doing this. And then, and everything can be done, right, for a price, right? Mm. So the way that we decided to work this is to keep what I've just said, that scenario, as a possibility. If we can license a track that they create exclusively and they want to do it, I don't know if they do, but if they want to do it, then we can explore that. But it all depends on what we get for our budget, how successful the Kickstarter is, whether we can add anything from, you know, film funds and other investment once we've got the Kickstarter funded and things like that. And eventually, you know, and whether we can get the deals done around the music. But what we can do is we can get them to curate music that we know we can license, which is there'll be a million tracks that we can source and look at, really unusual, interesting stuff. And I would say to you, look out for the music in the promo because it's really good. You'll love it with your synth hat on, Matt. It's very synthy. So that's why I, at this stage, I can only promise that, if that makes sense. So they're effectively DJing the movie.
Cool.
Yeah,
man.
Nice. Like it a lot. And I've got one more thing on the film, if you don't mind, Jason, is what's your involvement once it gets into production? If it gets into production, are you directing? Are you behind the scenes?
I like the when.
You in it?
The voodoo. I like the saying that when it gets into production. No, my wife is really keen. She keeps saying, "Say when." You get the universe behind you. So my involvement is is I'm like the engine for this project. Yeah. So I'm officially, obviously I'm the co-writer. I wrote it with Mark Felgate, but I'm also the producer of the film. So I'm getting involved in every single decision that happens until we're on set, right? And when we're on set, then Elizabeth takes over and I shut up and let Elizabeth, and she's nobody's fool. She'll soon have the measure of me if I'm chatting too much and getting involved and questioning things. She'll run that set, yeah? And I will just have to do her bidding while that's happening, because when you make a movie for not very much money, you have to do a huge amount of pre-production, because that's relatively cheap. That's effectively organizing your troops, getting everything in the right position. And you can take several months to do that. Once the film starts film, and I'll be involved intimately in that. So that she'll say something like, right, there's a scene where a coach crashes, right? How are we going to do that? Right. And I'll say, well, my mate's, friend owns a bus company and we can borrow a bus for 2 days. Really? Yeah. What about insurance? What about drivers? What about this? Well, and then we'll hash it all out. So then let's say I've got this coach for a few hundred quid on some private land, so I don't have to worry about the insurance or whatever, right? And then we'll film it. And then we might want to then go to a special effects person and then get them to do some kind of clever rendering of that so we can crash it without actually crashing it, right? And I'm not going to let on whether this is a real scene or not. You'll have to see the final movie. You'll have to fund it to find out. But does that make sense? So we have all these conversations. Yeah. And I'm solving problems at that point for the director, right? And she's in LA, so a lot of this is going to happen on Zoom, right? And then sourcing locations, Zoom calling her from a location. I think this is a really good corner shop or supermarket that we can use. This is a really cool garage forecourt where we can have some newspapers where you'll surreptitiously just notice that the AI is being rolled out globally, you know, AI Day on the front of the newspaper. The actual expo, still don't have that location yet. Doesn't have to be an actual expo. It just needs to be a building. Like maybe it's a school in the school holidays, and we can, you know, maybe someone's dad's on the school board and we can get it for free. You get what I mean? I'll be doing all that stuff. Right. And then the casting and that, I'll be suggesting people. Elizabeth though will ultimately make those final decisions, because you can't employ someone, you know, in any regard, can you? It don't matter what you do for a living, right? You can't bring someone on who's got a specialized skill set and then just tell them what to do. You've got to, you can suggest stuff, but you've got to sit back a little bit, right? And some of the main casting is already done, even now, before the Kickstarter is even live, right? Because in order to do some of the teaser footage and know that we could do it, we had to make some casting decisions. But there's some really great roles in the movie, which it was very interesting. I had a conversation with Elizabeth, the director, recently. And I said, oh, what do you think about this character? And again, I'm not going to give too much away, but she just dropped a name from it, like a British sitcom actress from like 1985. And I was like, that is such a good idea. Like it hadn't even, do you know what I mean? It hadn't even occurred to me. I was on a stream the other day on TikTok and I mentioned the movie and I mentioned the idea in a funny way of who could be cast in it to get a bit of publicity so that people think it's funny. And someone in chat said, Sid Little's got to be in it. And I actually thought, you know what? I don't know whether Sid Little's well enough to do it. I don't know. But I thought that's not a bad idea. Someone like, you know, someone from a kid's game show in the 90s or the 80s. Do you know what I mean? Someone like, you know, Timmy Mallet, like what, all these sorts of names, you suddenly start to think, actually, as a cameo walk-on, there's some really fun things we can do. But anyway, I'll be doing all the pre-pro and then I'll then just be running around doing what I'm told during the filming, which will probably take about 2 weeks. That might surprise you. When you've got a low budget, you can't take 3 months to film a movie. 2 weeks, two and a half weeks, 3 weeks. And then I will be intimately involved in the edit. Intimately involved in the edit of the promo, the 4 minute promo. I love editing, but I wasn't hands on. Our director of photography, Sam, he was editing that. I don't know if I'll be able to persuade Sam to do the real movie edit, but I'll be sat behind whoever's doing it, you know, giving loads of input. Yeah. So intimately involved throughout the whole process.
Feels to me, I hope you don't mind me saying this, there's 12-year-old or something, 12-year-old Jason this is his dream coming true. You are really knocking on that door of that young Jason and going, there you go, son. Yeah. I did it for you. Because it's, you know, and you say it also in very endearingly, you know, I've got a mate, Elizabeth, who's a director, with, you know, all these lovely contacts that you're bringing together.
Yeah.
But it's almost like you're in the playground going, oh, I've got someone whose dad's got a bus that I can crash.
It's literally,
you know?
Like, and that, just, dude.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. And I think we can all relate to that. We've all been that kid going, oh, I'd love to do like computer game, a film.
Yeah, to make my own game, write a book. Yeah, exactly. Brilliant. Yeah, get my own arcade, Dean. That, you know what I mean? That's what we're talking about.
That's what I'm working on, obviously. Yeah.
He's done it. He's realised the dream, haven't you, Dean?
Trying.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Jason. I think you've explained everything to us so beautifully and with passion, as we expected, no less. Dean, have you got anything else to throw past Jason?
Well, I think
Jason
sounds great. I just think, you know, our listeners are going to be well into this idea. So it sounds great. And I'm pleased you've been on, Jason.
Gentlemen, thank you.
It's really nice of you to come on and talk to us about this. It just sounds amazing.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. And you know, I didn't want to just keep going on and on about it, but you asked some really good questions and you really made me think, actually. But yeah, thank you. I'm a big fan of the show and, you know, thanks for the opportunity.
It's been a pleasure having you on, Jason. Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you so much. And best of luck with it. And yeah, I think Dean summed it up. It's going to appeal to this demographic so much, but I hope it appeals to a wider audience as well, because this kind of, again, the British vibe, the time capsule thing, it needs to be seen by way more people. So I really hope it spreads and goes viral.
Thanks, guys.
Well, there you go. Did you enjoy that? Because I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I said just before it, what a great 2 hours we had talking to him. A little bit indulgent from me even before the show. Dean got a little bit bored because me and Jason started talking about synthesizers and 80s
I wasn't
synth kit
bored. I find it interesting. I don't know what you're on about, but yeah, I find it interesting.
I spotted, listeners, if you look behind, if you rewind this on the video version and look behind, go to YouTube because there's the video version on YouTube, by the way.
There is, yes.
Go and check that out and you can see us looking very awkward and Jason looking totally slick because he's been on TV a million times.
Yeah, you've seen behind me falling asleep and dribbling.
Yeah, but he had a couple of synthesizers behind him on the floor and I couldn't help but ask, being an absolute synth kid myself. So we had about a 5-10 minute chat about that before we even started. But yeah, really great chat, really, really interesting as well. So that project will be live on Kickstarter on the 27th
September. And there is links, I promise to you, that they've done, because the video version I edited and it's all ready and waiting to be published. It will actually go out a day later than this show. But all the links are there, and I'll just copy and paste those into the podcast show notes as well. So if you want to back this project or see the full trailer or just stalk Jason on his Twitter page, all the links are there.
Yeah, lovely, lovely. So that was a great show, Dean. Really enjoyed doing that. It was a good to come back and do something like that as well. So,
well, it's been great having you back on, and hopefully
I'll get back in the box now, mate. I'll get back in the box.
No,
that was a bit. Well, no, it's this time of year, isn't it? Yeah, every time this autumn
starts
coming.
Yes, we always mention this, don't we?
Every year.
As the nights start drawing in, you get into your game in a bit.
I do, absolutely. Yeah. And it runs through until the nights start getting light again. Well, so I've got myself a little emulation handheld, which I showed on the show.
Yeah.
And I've got my Steam Deck, and I'll probably have a Spectrum. But no, I will get some kits set up because I really do enjoy gaming on these dark nights. I love it. Yeah. I love it. It's great.
I think, you know, in this country, this year's been really strange. The beginning of summer was pretty bad, and then it has got better. But when it is nice, do get out. Do, you know, go for walks and make the most of life. And when it's cold and wet and damp and dark, play the games and listen. Absolutely. Well, you can listen to us all year round. That's the good thing.
Yeah, there's a nice bit of mental health stuff there, Dean. Genuinely,
there is,
you know,
get out and get some exercise and just enjoy the outdoors every now and then. It's no good staying cooped up indoors. But yeah, you know, I'm with you, Matt. When it starts getting darker, I don't know, I just feel even more nostalgic about video games.
Mm.
you said it to me once. I don't know whether on the show or in the chat once. You said it's obvious why. It's because when you're a kid, you stopped going out and playing with your mates as much as dark. You weren't allowed out in some cases because it was too dark. Don't know, in East London for you, mate, you probably went out there and sort of got all your down the chip shop and all that sort of stuff.
Well, that's when we went out robbing and, you know, bringing
exactly
stuff back to the
Us in little villages, in rural little villages, we were scared of you East End folk, you see. So we weren't allowed out. But it's true, wasn't it? You know, you wouldn't go out with your mates so much. You'd sit in your bedroom at night. It was dark. Of course you get nostalgic this time of year because it reminds you of doing that more. Yeah. We didn't play games as much in the summer probably as we did in the winter when we were kids. No. So
I probably played more arcade games in the summer, but that was about it.
Yeah. All good. Nice. Well, that is a wonderful show, done and dusted. Thank you, everyone, for listening to it, of course.
I hope you've enjoyed it. And we might have a few new listeners because of super stardom there, you know, now that I'm a radio pundit.
They're going to drag you in whenever they want something on retro gaming. Ring ding. You're going to be the guy.
On the box now.
Like what Jason said, he was called up about the iPhone 16 launch. You know, he did a load of interviews for that. I don't know whether he mentioned that. Totally on the show. He definitely mentioned some of it, but he was called up and he had stacks of interviews the days before our interview with him. You're just going to become that version of that for anything retro.
Fingers crossed.
Ring up things. You're going to turn up on these Channel 5 programs, you know, where they put in a load of people you've never really heard of to talk about something they show on there. Dean Swain, Retro Asylum podcast.
Retro
host. There you go. And you'll be looking just off camera like a professional.
Well, don't forget James as well. He took part.
Of course. No, I'm joking. They'll wheel you both out. You're the two new faces.
We'll never hear from them again.
You've got the thousands of Retro Asylum listeners, mate.
That's it. That's enough.
You don't need anyone else.
That's enough.
Big shout to the patrons, of course.
Absolutely.
Thank you for keeping the show up and running. And every time I see that list, because I don't look at it quite as often as probably what you do, I'm just amazed by the amount of folk we have
it's
on
a
there
long
list. And the trust that you put in this show to support it. It's brilliant. It is humbling, I think.
Definitely.
Wonderful.
Definitely.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, everybody. Tune in next time. Retro Asylum, of course. Thank you very much.
We'll be back with a bump down to Earth or something.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, see you soon.
See you later.
Bye. Hi there, joystick and joypad wagglers. Here is a look at the multi-format software charts from May 1986. Winter Games is a non-mover at number 10 for Epics and US Gold Software. Hypersports by Imagine is down 3 places from 6 to 9. Imagine Software's Movie slips to 8 from 5. Aerialsoft's Sky Fox is a re-entry at number 7. One Man and His Droid slips 3 places to number 6 for Mastertronic. FA Cup Football is the second highest new entry for Virgin at number 5. Rambo proves to be a winner for Ocean, moving up from 12 to number 4. Formula One Simulator slips down 1 place at number 3 for Mastertronic. Last month's number 1 slips down to 2. Yes, it's Yee-Haw Kung Fu for Imagine. Which means that this month's number 1 is a new entry for US Gold with Hardball, which at this moment in time was only available for the Commodore 64.